This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Fume. Fume cartridges are crafted from medical-grade polyester designed for use with essential oils. Fume, a non-vape, non-nicotine, non-tobacco device, works by replacing the hand-to-mouth fixation, calming nervous tension through fidgeting, and distracts you from the bad habits with delicious flavors. Psychologists have shown stopping a bad habit cold turkey is very hard for your brain. The Fume handheld device has a built-in fidget, also has a weight similar to most vape pens. If you're interested in replacing old bad habits with new good habits, head on over to tryfume.com/D410M and get yourself a free pack of toppers with your purchase. The toppers is a perfect new accessory designed with your comfort in mind. Slip it onto the mouthpiece for a softer, warmer feel. So replace those old habits with a new habit, a good habit. Simply go to tryfume.com/D410M. That's tryfume.com/D410M.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are here with another exceptional episode we're so excited to get to tonight. Real quick, a little house cleaning. Jeff will not be joining us tonight. He has some family concerns that need to be taken care of, but once again, we shall carry on like we always do. But joining us, as always, Mr. Dennis Blocker. Dennis, how you doing tonight, sir?
Doing excellent. Doing excellent. Super excited to have Mr. Newman with us tonight. Talk about the book. And I always love having writers on. Being a writer myself, I have so many questions. And yeah. Super stoked.
Yeah, I'm so disappointed that Jeff couldn't be here because he's talked up this book. I think over the last two episodes when we have the What You're Reading segment, Jeff has been talking gleefully about this book. And so we are finally going to get into it with our audience. And joining us from the East Coast as well, Dr. Roger Newman. Roger, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks for coming on with the book you were promoting, your new book, Boys. Before we get into it, because Dennis and I are both extremely interested in your writing styles. It's one of the things we like to ask authors when they come in is their process, their research, and then we kind of get into the book. But even before that, just give us a little, the elevator pitch on your background, your employment, things, notable things you've done in the past. What kind of got you in this particular subject, and what led to writing this book?
Well, I'm a physician. I'm a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. As long as I can remember, I've always wanted to write, but medical studies and early years of practice, I had stories in my head, but I never had the time to, didn't know if I could write. But as my career moved on in medicine, as I got later in my career and began to slow down some of my clinical practice and moved to really part-time, and also when the kids kind of finally all graduated, high school and went off to college and decided it was the time to give it a try. So around 2014, I wrote my first book. My first couple of books were medical thrillers because it's what I knew. It was the stories I had in my head. And after doing a series of three of those, I decided I wanted to try something else. And I've always been intrigued by history. So I did a historical fiction novel that touched on some of my wife's family history about a blockade runner during the Civil War. After finishing that, I was thinking, well, I ought to do something on my side of the family. So I dug into kind of a story that I had grown up with from my father's side of the family, about him growing up with a black brother and they're growing up together and going off to fight World War II together. And I just thought that story had always intrigued me as well. So thought it might make a good book. And so I started working on that about probably 2 years ago.
How does one go from taking family told stories? I'm sure there's some handwritten letters, some abbreviated documentation around, but how does someone take those stories and turn that into a full descriptive, full color book and bring it to life and the characters in such a beautiful way?
Well, in this case, it was, as I know you've probably talked about other people on your show, a lot of World War II veterans, which my father was, did not talk much about the war. And I think in the acknowledgement of this book, I make some note to the fact that one of my greatest regrets in life are all the conversations I never had with my dad.
Yeah.
So the information that I had about his military career and what he did in the military was really very slim. And that actually required more research. The stories about him growing up came from family stories. Not a lot of them, again, because he was estranged from his grandfather for a number of reasons. But talking from the stories that I knew and from talking to my siblings and the children of some of my father's brothers and sisters, I was able to get a good bit of information about their early growing up. Alex and Pete, who are the two characters in the novel, they're growing up together in Leakesville, North Carolina during the Great Depression. So that I had a framework for a story there. A lot of it is filled in with fiction, but I tried to keep the heart of that story in place. And then unfortunately, you know, I know that my dad and Alex went off when World War II started. After they graduated high school, they went off and enlisted together in the North Carolina National Guard, which eventually became the 30th Army Division, the old Hickory Division. But they were immediately separated because of their different races. And my father nor anyone else in the family ever heard from Alex again. There's no records that I've been able to find as to what might have happened to Alex, which probably is a result of a fire at an Army archive during the 70s.
Yes, but my family is also a victim of that fire. My grandfather, my mom's father, he worked grave registration over in Europe, and we've discussed this in the past, much like you're alluding to. Their generation didn't discuss it because everybody was there. They were humble. They didn't want to be considered braggadocious. But sadly for us, the following generations who are trying to keep this alive, with the exception of those who are lucky enough to have handwritten letters, maybe correspondence from our grandfathers to their sisters or wives, what have you, because we did the honorable thing, which was not to pester dad or pester grandfather about these horrible memories, they were unable to communicate those stories so we can carry on what they did. And that's the downside of us having respect for our elders back then.
Yeah, it's like I said, it was something I wish I hadn't. I wish I'd have been more persistent.
Yeah.
Every day, he was in the 120th Infantry Regiment of the. I don't know what company. I'm not positive which company, but he was in the 120th Infantry Regiment. Of the 30th Army Division.
Was he in that famous Hill 314 where they held back the German panzers on that hilltop?
Absolutely. And that's a big part of the story.
Great chapter in the book.
Yeah.
He was on top of the Hill 314, they called it, the Battle of Mortain, which an extremely underappreciated battle of importance.
And to that point, your book,
the reason,
go ahead, Dennis.
The reason that I asked is my great grandpa, I had two grandpas and a great grandpa in World War II. My great grandpa was in the 30th Infantry Division, 120th Regiment. And he went with them across the Normandy beaches that were, of course, D+4 or 6 or something like that. And so he was at Mortain and all that, went through France, then into Holland. And then they crossed over and he was killed 27 October 44. And he was killed in the Aachen, the siege of Aachen. So there's a huge connection there.
Absolutely.
And there's a Dutch, a Belgian family, the Meer family. They put flower. They have adopted his grave, and so we're Facebook friends with them, and we've sent them tons of pictures of him. And matter of fact, a couple of days ago, the Meer family went out to Henri Chapelle American Cemetery, and where a lot of the 30th guys are, and they sent us pictures of roses on his grave. So yeah, our family has a huge connection to that unit. 120th. Wow, what a small world.
When I started doing this book, I really didn't know about that story, and it's research that I did about my dad's unit and the 30th. And since finishing the story, I'd love to get over to Europe and go to Mortain. And apparently there's quite a lovely memorial to that battle at the top of Hill 314. And I just love to see what my dad looked out over and saw those days that he was on top of that hill.
They single-handedly held back 6 Panzer divisions, if I'm not mistaken. And they're credited with saving the saving everything. I know that when the Battle of Bulge happened, that they plugged in the 30th because they were Old Hickory and they were reliable and they were a veteran. And
the Battle of the Bulge would have never happened.
That's right.
If the 120th Infantry hadn't held and repelled the German counterattack at Mortain, because the Germans were. The reason they committed all those panzers and all their Luftwaffe and all the troops was they wanted to break through the American line and cut off Patton's panzer. I mean, not panzer, but Patton's armored divisions that had taken the breakout from Normandy and had raced across the middle of France on their way to Paris. And if the Germans had been able to take Mortain and push the Americans back to the port city, and I'm not sure I'm saying it right, of Arvanches, if they could have done that, it would have completely cut off Patton's armor from their resupply. And they could have picked them off. And who knows how much longer that, you know, the battle for Europe would have taken if they hadn't have held and repulsed the Germans at Mortain and allowed what they called the breakout from Normandy to continue. So it's just that battle in and of itself is great, great history that isn't well enough known. If there's any light on that, that would be something I'd be proud of.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You're referencing the Battle of the Bulge, and as we all know historically, the reason it's called the Bulge is because the way it bulged, the front line bulged. But Hill 314 would almost be like the Battle of the Island, right? Because they're completely surrounded. They're up on the hill.
They were.
They're completely cut off, taken hammering. And the idea that you're completely surrounded, and much like the Battle of the Bulge, you're low on ammunition, but you have to basically rely on, let's be honest, less than accurate airdrops. I mean, part of the reason why the losses on D-Day were so high is because the aircraft didn't quite hit their marks to create the craters on the landing beaches, so we have places to get out from the fire. And now you have these guys basically pinned down on top of this high ground, because everybody knows when it comes to combat, you want the high ground. He who holds the high ground wins. And they're trying to hold on to that with the, you know, the minimums, and then they're just... And we heard about the Battle of the Bulge as well, right? You know, oh, here comes the airdrops, and there they go right into the German lines. Yeah. I hope that was just socks. And not,
at one point at Mortain, when they were running out of, they were running out of ammunition, running out of medical supplies and food, but the really critical aspect of what they ran out of was that their batteries on their radios were going dead. And the reason that Hill 314 was so valuable because it allowed the spotters to call in artillery on all the German activity that was literally all around them. So they tried to shoot shells. I forget the size of the shells, but apparently the artillery was shooting shells filled with, you know, medical supplies and radios and into their position, which was probably only, you know, maybe 100 square yards or something like that. I don't know how big it was, but you know, it was dangerous to have your artillery bombing you with supplies. You
know, enough of it what survived the impact that it did prove the difference, you know.
Yeah, some of the radios would survive. My father was a medic. None of the plasma or anything like that survived. But food and some of the food and the radios were successfully delivered by rocket shell.
Don't ever miscalculate the durability of a K ration and a can of Spam. But yeah, you know, it's like they say, necessity is the mother of invention, but desperation is the mother of insanity. I mean, just could you imagine presenting that idea? Hey, I got an idea. We're going to take an empty shell casing. We're going to stuff it full of goods, and we're going to lob it up there and hope that we don't hit somebody in the process. And if we do, it's casualty of war. Just the whole concept of that is crazy.
Yeah. And also, one of the other things they did at Mortain again was, as you said, they tried the airdrops, but Mortain was a relatively narrow target on top of a